candidates are everywhere. They're coming out of the woodwork. And hosts of radio interview programs everywhere are smiling. Oakland County Clerk Lisa Brown will be Mark Schauer's running mate as Lieutenant Governor for the Democrats this fall. That was just announced yesterday. A little bit closer to home here, I guess the East Lansing school system is down to, has narrowed the field of candidates for superintendent of East Lansing schools down to 3 candidates, and there's a second round of interviews planned for 6 o'clock on April 24th at the East Lansing High School cafeteria on Bertram Drive here in East Lansing. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Later on this hour, our latest book review, Matthew Quick's The Good Luck of Right Now. Scott Southard revisits us with a review, and we also learn about the expanding trail network here in Michigan. All coming up here on Current State. We hope you can stay close. In fewer than 24 hours, the race for Michigan's 8th Congressional District picked up 2 new candidates. Both are Oakland County Republicans. Rochester Hills Mayor Brian Barnett, with Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson at his side, announced his candidacy on Tuesday. Barnett said his experience as mayor has provided him a unique perspective and that he's seen what effective leadership can do and how it can deliver results. Yesterday, of course, former State Senate Majority Leader Mike Bishop entered the fray, saying he wants to cut federal spending and work to repeal Obamacare. Current State has reached out to both of these candidates about appearing on our program, and we're pleased Mayor Brian Barnett could join us today. Mayor Barnett, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Why did you decide to become a candidate?
Well, that's a great opening question and one that you can answer relatively quickly, but it takes a significant amount of soul searching to put yourself out in a position where you basically have to give up your summer and your current career path and look at what you might hope to do in Congress. I've been very blessed to be the mayor of an absolutely fantastic community, the city of Rochester Hills, for the past 8 years. And over that time, I've been able to affect, I think, some very positive change in our community and deliver some what I think are very positive results. And I've been encouraged by a lot of folks. I truly am blessed to have a job that I love. I enjoy coming to work every morning. I think public service is an honorable calling, and when an opportunity presents itself, when you have a chance to provide that service for even more residents on an even larger scale, those of us who have it in their blood, I think, are drawn to that possibility and are attracted to that opportunity, and that's exactly what's happened. I first, of course, talked with my wife and my boys, and they're, of course, very supportive, and now we've been working over the past 5 or 6 days to begin to spread our message and to work with the folks who want to come alongside and support us.
You have a strong mayor form of government in the city of Rochester Hills, as we have here in Lansing. What have been particular priorities of yours as an elected official in Rochester Hills?
Sure. Well, I think that's unique, too. There aren't a lot of strong mayors in the state of Michigan. I think there are 12 cities, and of course what that means is I'm the CEO of the community, responsible for the day-to-day operations. We don't have a city manager. I'm really able to put into practice and ultimately responsible at the end of the day for the success or failure of programs in our community. And one area that has been an extreme focus of mine has been on attracting jobs and job-creating companies to our community. I really feel that that's an exceptionally important program and an especially important aspect of any community that really impacts everything from property values to crime rates. And so we've put together some pretty innovative programs. I have what's called the Mayor's Business Council, which is just sort of the C-suite executives of companies in Rochester Hills. So we're sort of uniquely vested in our community's success.
Brian, will job creation be a focus of your campaign?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's not just talking about it. We put together some pretty unique programs, and the result is that the city of Rochester Hills currently enjoys the second lowest unemployment rate in the state of Michigan. And that right now hovers between 3.9 and 4.2%. So we've got some good results to show for some of our work, and you know, we've really been focused on you know, knowledge, sort of the knowledge-based economy. We're the robotic capital of North America in Rochester Hills, so we've attracted a lot of companies that are in the robotics industry, and so absolutely, you know, Mark, job creation will be a key focus of what we talk about in this campaign moving forward.
How'd you manage to get the endorsement of L. Brooks Patterson, especially since Mr. Patterson couldn't be certain who else might be running?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, obviously we've received a lot of endorsements right out of the gate. Of course, also Sheriff Michael Bouchard and many of the other township leaders in Oakland County. You know, and I think, of course, for those in Oakland County, what that means is, you know, they've seen my work ethic. They've seen how I operate and what I've been able to deliver on a local level. And I think that speaks volumes for, you know, being the candidate out of Oakland County with those endorsements. But for those that perhaps haven't had a chance to, that I haven't had a chance to meet in Livingston and in Ingham, I think it gives you some credibility, certainly in not just in the Republican Party, but I think, you know, statewide, I think Brooks is viewed as an effective leader, and I think a lot of people, you know, have respected. You know, he's been on both sides of the aisle on issues in the past, and you know, I think people recognize and respect his leadership. So I think it gives folks in Livingston and Ingham counties a little bit of hopefully support in terms of the credibility that I bring, and I think it's an honor to have folks like that line up behind you.
The conventional wisdom is that both parties would like to avoid an intense primary battle. How much stomach do you have for a contentious primary against Mike Bishop?
Yeah, well, you know, Mike and I live about 3 miles from each other, and we have, you know, we've always been friendly, and I, you know, I certainly it's my intention that that we stay that way, and we'll see how things move forward. You know, I think there's, you know, the thing that I have to do, and that he'll have to do as well, is to just draw on our past and differentiate how our leadership styles would be different moving forward, and that's where I think the fact that you know, if you talk to most people, and even the folks that I've talked to in the first few days of this campaign, you know, I would tell you that the numbers that I've heard for, you know, people who are happy with how Congress has operated, you know, if it is a double digit number, I haven't met those people. It's pretty low, and I think folks are tired of you know, the rhetoric and just the constant gridlock. And
Mike Bishop said yesterday that if he's elected, he'll work to repeal Obamacare. Do you share that priority?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that at all. I mean, I've seen how it's impacted my community. I've seen how it's impacted my business operations here at the city, and certainly that's something that I would work to do as well. But I think there's a different way that we would work. What would you
propose as a way to address? I mean, healthcare costs are an enormous problem in this country. What would you propose as an alternative?
Well, I think that there's, you know, there are several options that are out there that I think, you know, there are parts of all of them or parts of several of them that I think are interesting. Let me tell you what I know. You know, as the leader of this municipal government, my health care costs go up about 22%, 15 to 22% each year. And as soon as Obamacare was, you know, as parts of it were implemented here, those costs skyrocketed. I, you know, covering 26-year-olds on day one cost our community about another $45,000.
But what would you do differently, though?
Right. Well, you know, I'm not sure that the Republican Party has coalesced around an alternative. And I would say the same thing. I haven't seen the silver bullet that says this is what exactly we would replace this with. I think there are parts of lots of different people's plans that I have seen that I'm attracted to. But to tell you today, Mark, that I have the silver bullet solution replacement for Obamacare would not be accurate. I just know that what we've seen and how it's been enacted so far has hurt small businesses like the business of Rochester Hills.
Where do you stand regarding gay marriage? Certainly an issue that's been in the news a lot here in Michigan.
Right. You know, it came to our city, and there was a group of folks that wanted to see the city pass a human rights ordinance. And my position at the time, and it remains the same, is that, you know, if the state wants to take this up as a ballot measure, you know, obviously I think that would be the appropriate way to look at this. I don't think it's appropriate for individual communities to have individual stances on this. It's not an effective measure. I personally believe in the traditional definition of marriage, but you know, obviously it's something that the, you know, if the state wanted to approach and it was a ballot measure, you know, I would obviously respect the wishes of the voters of the state of Michigan.
The most recent Kids Count survey showed Michigan kids, and we talked about this on yesterday's program. We're talking with Rochester Hills Mayor Brian Barnett, by the way, a candidate for the 8th Congressional District here in Michigan. This Kids Count survey showed Michigan children are considerably less well off than most in the country. African American children in particular are living among the poorest conditions in the nation. Aside from promoting job creation, what would you do to address the declining fortunes of Michigan's future generations?
Right. Well, you know, every child deserves an exceptional education, and it shouldn't matter, you know, the zip code from which you hail from. And the question I always ask is, you know, if I'm ever with a group of people or talking education, is, you know, how many of you think your quality of life is better than your parents? And most of the hands go up in the room. The next question you ask is, how many of you think that your kids' quality of life will be better? And most of those hands go down. And that's a problem. And I know the education discussion will be a major part of what Congress has to work with, and what, you know, will probably be a discussion of this campaign moving forward. I have two boys. They're both in the public school system. They're third and fourth graders. I'm heavily involved in our schools. I was in as a math tutor last week. You know, this is an issue that I think, you know, to me, this is more important than the discussion of what the minimum wage should be. I mean, raising minimum wage is not the answer. The answer is providing an education. When we're living in a world where low-skilled jobs, I think, are going to become less and less of a factor, and even less and less available, and education needs to be what our extreme focus needs to be. So next to job creation, Mark, I mean, education is, I think, will be a strong focus and should be for the next person who represents the 8th Congressional District.
Have you been a supporter of expanding the Common Core standards to Michigan?
I have not been a supporter, and frankly, that conversation, you know, as a mayor, you know, my interaction with that, as the mayor, I don't run the school system or have close interaction with the school system from a governance standpoint. As a mayor, though, I do feel, and I'm pretty passionate about this, that local control and flexibility is important. And so, again, I think that a system that provides total local control, what works in the Rochester Hill, you know, Rochester Community District, may not be necessarily the right thing that works in the Brighton District. And I want superintendents, teachers, parents, especially parents, to have flexibility and local control when they're talking about educating their kids.
Is support from Tea Party Republicans important to you?
It is. I mean, obviously, you know, this is considered a Republican seat, although it's not, it's not certainly, I don't think anybody would say it's a slam dunk Republican seat, but the polls tell you that the district leans Republican. So obviously it's important in a primary to make sure that you have as many of the Republican Party support, as much of the Republican Party support as you can. And in much of the district, the Tea Party is an important voice and has been an important voice on matters in the past. And I think that they'll like my record of fiscal responsibility. I'm happy to have them look at my record here in Rochester Hills, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that more as the campaign continues.
Has it crossed your mind that a close primary involving two Oakland County candidates might give a leg up to someone outside Oakland, Senator Joe Hewn, perhaps?
Yes. I mean, you know, of course, that's a consideration. I think that the field on April 23rd there's lots of what-if games, that are being played across the district and in Lansing. I was in Lansing all day yesterday in meetings and doing a couple presentations. And, I'm trying to just focus on my own scenario here, gaining the support for our team and getting our message out. April 23rd, we'll be able to really see who's in the race, and then we'll move forward from that point.
How would you assess Mike Rogers' performance in office?
Yeah, I thought Mike Rogers did a fantastic job. There are some things maybe that, I know he takes some heat on some of the issues, but, you know, in general, I was very pleased with his performance. I was shocked that he decided not to run. He was a friend. He did my introduction at the my State of the City just 3 weeks ago, video introduction for my State of the City. You know, you're always careful to throw stones until you've been in that position and know the challenges and the difficulty in balancing different factions and different perceptions and perspectives. It's difficult, you know. But in general, I thought he did a fine job, represented the district well, represented the state well, and I think he has a bright future.
Well, give us one other national issue that you find yourself really interested in that you would, you know, theoretically like to be involved in if you were successful in your campaign.
Sure. Well, like I said, I mean, you know, you have to pick the issues that you you can really dive deep into. And,
yeah.
And I think job creation will be first and foremost. And with that, there are, you know, obviously, you talk about the overreach of government, you talk about overregulation, those things I'm extremely passionate about. Education will be another one that I think, because, you know, I'm a father to a third and fourth grader, those kids, I mean, you know, this is where our future is, and this is something, obviously, that I'll spend an incredible amount of time on. Probably if there was a third issue, Mark, you know, I think immigration is going to be a challenging issue in the future, and it's something certainly we see the nation challenged with. You know, we're a nation of immigrants, but we're also a nation of laws. You know, and we have to find the balance between those you know, those two sort of, you know, large perspectives and large opinions, and I think that'll be an issue that this country, you know, no matter your district or no matter your party, we're going to have to grapple with that and figure out a way forward that makes sense. So those three issues, I think, will be interesting issues moving forward.
All right. Brian Barnett is the Republican mayor of Rochester Hills. He is the first of at least a few Republicans who have announced their candidacy for the for the 8th Congressional District, which, of course, includes Lansing and East Lansing. Brian Barnett, good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. A new exhibit at the MSU Museum focuses on the plight of turtles around the world. Turtles in Trouble is the name of it, and WKAR's Melissa Benmark has been exploring it. What'd you find out, Melissa?
Well, we're looking at an exhibit that's really meant to boost the awareness of the kind of impact that humans have on turtle populations worldwide. And it's a complicated matter. A lot of it has to do with how long turtles live and egg mortality and all kinds of things like that. I spoke with MSU Museum's Jim Harding. He's an instructor there and an advisor in zoology at MSU. And he's a specialist in wildlife outreach, and he has all kinds of cool critter things in his office. I could have just spent all day looking at the cool critter things in his office. And he told me that this exhibit is really an unusual combination of science and art.
The MSU Museum has been making an effort, especially in one of our upper floor galleries, to combine art and science and cultural things, you know. And we recently met a gentleman who does the most amazing ceramic sculptures of turtles, both Michigan turtles and turtles from different parts of the world, turtles and tortoises. And I, for years, have been trying to do an exhibit or get an exhibit going here at the museum just on turtles to make people aware of the plight of turtles and turtle conservation. And so I thought, wow, okay, this may be an opportunity.
Talk about some of the environmental concerns that are going on with the turtle population worldwide right now.
Turtles start out with a basic problem. They've been a successful group of animals in the fossil record, we find them as long ago as there were dinosaurs. So in other words, 220, 225 million years ago. So they've been around a long time, and you can say they've been very successful, and turtles can be very common even today in some situations. But basically, turtles have a problem in that most of their eggs are eaten by animals before they hatch, And their little bite-sized babies are also eaten by lots of different things. And so nature has, I'm sure this has gone on for millions of years, but nature made up for this by, turtles evolving to have very long lives compared to other wild animals. Turtles, you know, an average turtle lives 40 or 50 years, and there are many that surpass the century mark. So turtles live long lives because that way the females can produce a clutch or two of eggs every year. And even though most of those eggs never result in adult turtles, a few of them might because these animals have so long to do it. So what's happening now is that over the whole world, wherever there are turtles, they are being exploited by humans at a rate that's far higher than they can hope to replace. You can gather a lot of turtle eggs and still have turtles around because, you know, we are just acting as egg predators. But if you start exploiting adult turtles and tortoises, then the population will plummet pretty quickly because they don't have the longevity to replace themselves. And that's basically what's happening. Here in Michigan, of course, we do have some species that are threatened or of special concern. And then worldwide, just the increase in human population, the increase in economic well-being of different populations. For example, I don't pick on any one ethnic group, but just as an example, over in Southeast Asia and in China, we have seen a growth just in the last few decades of the middle class. You know, their economics have turned around. So even though people always ate turtles, it was usually a local phenomenon. You know, people would collect turtles locally for their own soup pots, but, they would never take them all or, you know, it never made a significant impact on them. But now there's a huge commercial trade because you have these huge urban populations that wanted to eat turtles or use them for medicine. And so there's this tremendous economic impetus to collect turtles, ship them en masse in the markets, and turtles just can't handle that. And so right now the result is that the turtles and tortoises are probably among the most endangered groups of vertebrate animals on Earth.
With kids in particular who see exhibits, how do you get them interested in turtles without potentially contributing to the phenomenon of them coming home with turtles that end up in a box in their bedroom, which is, you know, kind of defeats the purpose of the education?
That's a really good question, because if I said that people should never keep turtles as pets, I would be a horrible hypocrite. Because I grew up as a little boy getting interested in natural history in part by keeping animals that I found. You know, my dad was pretty strict. You know, he let me keep these things for a while, especially when I was much younger, you know, and couldn't care for things properly. He recognized that, and he'd say, well, you can keep that turtle in your sandbox for, you know, a day or two, and then we're going to take it down to the pond and let it go. But after a while, you know, I learned proper husbandry, and I learned how to keep these things alive, and I gained a lot from it. So if I said people should never keep turtles as pets, I'd be simply hypocritical. In fact, I still have a few that, you know, I tell people they are scientific specimens, but really I enjoy them enough to call them pets. So
they have names?
Exactly, yeah, you know. But on the other hand, we cannot be going out into the wild and picking up turtles left and right. We can't be running them over with our cars. We can't be draining the swamps and the marshlands. There are so many things we're doing to impact turtles, and if people went out and collected turtles, especially the rarer species that people really want to keep as pets, like box turtles and so on, these are protected in Michigan, and it is illegal to pick them up, and we shouldn't. So if somebody wanted a pet turtle, there are many captive bred sources now. You do not have to go out in the wild and capture a turtle, and we heartily discourage that. But you can find legitimate up-and-up breeders of turtles to, stay above the on the sunny side of the law and so you can find turtles as pets. Not everybody should have a turtle as a pet. You know, it shouldn't be and they certainly shouldn't be throwaway pets. If you get a turtle or a tortoise as a pet, this is a long-term investment.
I'm sort of confounded by the car thing because it seems like it's not like bunnies that run back and forth at lightning speed and you really, really try hard not to hit them. I mean, it's not, and I know some could be moving at night, but it seems like if you were paying attention, you wouldn't have to hit that many turtles with your car.
You know, I'm absolutely amazed sometimes at how turtles get hit in the road. I see these beautiful big Blandings turtles or even the even bigger snapping turtles hit in the middle of the road. I mean, not a busy highway. I mean, like a side street. And I keep thinking, come on, folks, if that was a rock in the middle of the road, would you hit it? How do you hit something the size of a bigger than a football, you know, in the middle of the road? I don't know. But you bring up a very serious problem because road crossing mortality is a serious, what biologists call a population sink. It means it's basically a place where turtles go to die. And as we've already discussed, you can't lose a lot of adult turtles and expect your population of turtles to exist for very long. I would say, even though I'm opposed to pet collecting and especially commercial pet collecting, I have to say that if for most species, road mortality probably kills hundreds of times more turtles than small children picking one up off the sidewalk. You know, thousands of turtles are killed on roads every year, and it's a significant loss. It's a significant problem.
We were talking a little bit before the interview about young people coming up in your field, mm-hmm. and it's not all that easy to get a job doing what you do, especially in the herpetology world. What would your advice be to young people who are just starting to realize that they're fascinated with these millions of year old creatures? I mean, you know, the species having been around for millions of years.
Right, right. No. Yeah, I get approached by, college students and prospective college students all the time that say, you know, I've always loved, you know, reptiles, or I've always loved snakes, and I've always loved, or, you know, like as we were saying, big cats, or, dramatic, romantic animals. And, I'd love to have a career that dealt with these. And the thing is, the number of jobs that come up each year for herpetologists, you know, the people who study reptiles and amphibians, or ornithologists or marine mammals, the number of positions are just going to be very few every year. I never tell a student they can't accomplish something. I do tell them that they may need to work very hard and be very focused. We were also discussing the fact that you do not have to be a biologist to contribute to these fields. A lot of people, for example, just in herpetology and in turtle biology and turtle conservation, a lot of the people who are involved with it are not trained biologists. Getting back to our exhibit here at the museum, Mark Mewich, our ceramic artist here, who we're going to be displaying the works of, is doing a tremendous amount to get the word out about turtles and turtle conservation, and he is not trained as an ecologist or biologist.
One final question. If people are aware that there are turtles on their property, is there anything they can do, you know, short of obviously being careful with the car, is there anything they can do that will be helpful in terms of increasing the odds that some of the eggs will survive or anything like that?
One rule, I think, if you have habitat on your property and you have turtles and, you know, other interesting creatures like snakes and whatnot, make sure your habitat stays free of pollution. Turtles are pretty sensitive, but as we said, frogs are even more sensitive. So leaving them alone, you know, just simply let them go. You know, don't try to interfere too much. If a turtle digs a hole in your petunia bed and buries its eggs there, don't be too upset. So he throws a few flowers aside, you know, to let them do that. Now, if you want to protect a nest of eggs, there are ways of doing that. Sometimes the easiest way is to just take an old window screen, throw it over the top of the ground where the nest is, and weight it down with bricks. And that'll keep the egg predators like raccoons and coyotes and foxes and things from digging up the eggs and eating them. Of course, you've got to remove that screen in late summer, before the turtles hatch or they'll be trapped there. But that is an easy way to do it. But on the other hand, simply watching it, not doing anything to disturb it, may allow that nest to hatch. Now, if the young turtles hatch out and you find them in the fall and they're wandering across your driveway and, getting stuck in your window wells and things, then sure, you can help them out. You can pick them up, put them in a bucket, and carry them down to the edge of the pond and let them go, because that's where they really wanted to go anyway. So there are things we can do. We can sometimes interfere. If somebody knocks on your door and says, "Hey, can I trap turtles in your pond?" Say, no, we want them there. We'll just leave them there. We're happy to have them.
Well, Jim Harding, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
A reminder, you can follow Current State on Twitter at KAR Current State. You can email us at currentstate@wkar.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. Spring planting season for corn in Michigan is still at least a month away, but scientists who study the crop's amazing versatility want you to cast your vote for a homegrown project. The Michigan Biotechnology Institute, or MBI, is developing a process that seeks to get more use out of the leftover residue of the plant that's not fit for human consumption. Here to explain more is Current State's Kevin Lavery. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Mark.
So what's this project all about?
Mark, this project that MBI is working on is called AFEX. That stands for ammonia fiber expansion. Several years ago, a chemist at Michigan State University named Bruce Dale developed a way of treating the non-grain parts of the corn plant, that's called corn stover, with ammonia. What that does is it releases the sugars inside the plant that make really an excellent feedstock for cattle. It's also a promising bio-based fuel source. Now, the project has been nominated for a national award, and MBI is encouraging the MSU community to get online and vote for AFEX. I spoke with Jim Nguyen about this. Jim is the director of bio-based technology de-risking at MBI. He says at harvest time, only about half of the corn plant is used, and the rest just lies there on the field.
Now, some of that is useful in that it goes back into the soil as a fertilizer, but over half of it can actually be removed without affecting the soil and used for more useful purposes. Currently, because you can't get at the sugars in that biomass, it's of very little value. But with the AFEX technology, you have a way of unlocking the value in that agricultural waste to use as a potential cattle feed or for use to make bio-based chemicals and fuels.
So if I'm the kind of guy that enjoys putting gas in my car and eating an occasional hamburger, and I'll check yes for both of those boxes, this is something that is going to eventually, once this is commercialized, truly benefit my quality of life.
It will allow you to both fill your tank with gas and eat your steak, absolutely. We can either replace corn, grain in cattle feed, or make biofuels and biochemicals without needing to grow any more crops at all.
And as you said, Jim, because MBI is a scale-up operation, meaning you take small quantities of a substance and you demonstrate that a certain material can be used in larger quantities for commercial use. The point I'm getting at here is we're reaching a point where the public really should be excited about this technology, really.
Absolutely. We have taken the technology from lab scale, which is a 10-liter reactor scale, up to a pilot plant, which is a 1,000-liter reactor scale. So we've scaled up 100 times. The first demo scale, which will be a commercially viable scale, will be only about 20 to 40 times bigger than our current pilot scale. So we are now on the verge of being able to take this transformative technology into the real world. Let's go upstairs and look at the big reactor.
Okay, let's go. We're walking into a room that has a lot of this corn stover here, and I see many signs on the door that say danger ammonia. What's so dangerous about ammonia, Jim?
Well, ammonia is a gas which is used very commonly on farms all over the US currently as a fertilizer. We use it as a nitrogen source on many farms. However, it's a gas which can be poisonous at certain concentrations. And so because we are practicing this technology inside a building, we are very careful about the way we treat it. We have very, very high safety standards here. And of course, in a lab setting, we are always extremely careful about how we handle any chemical which can be considered dangerous. And ammonia is a gas which, because of its toxicity to humans and other animals, we have to treat with respect. So this is our pilot scale. And you can see it's actually a very simple reactor. The reactors are these tall steel columns to your left. And they're about 10 feet high and about 18 inches in diameter. And they're essentially just pipes. And we pack these pipes with the corn stover in baskets, and then we steam them, we pre-steam them to add a bit of moisture, add a bit of water, and to just warm them up. And then we introduce gaseous ammonia. And then the ammonia actually dissolves in the water in the biomass, generating more heat. It's an exothermic reaction, means it gives off heat. And the combination of the ammonia and the heat treats the biomass, and it causes changes in the biomass which makes the cellulose portion, which is the part of the biomass containing all the sugar, becomes more available and more easily broken down. And it can be broken down even by enzymes, which we can add to make sugar solutions for fermentation, or it can be broken down by the bacteria in the guts of cattle to allow cattle to release the sugar energy available in the corn stover.
You told me earlier that this is a dry-in, dry-out process, and that you can make the end product more dense and it's easier to ship.
When we get the biomass out of the reactor, we can put it into a pelletizer, and the pelletizer makes nice dense pellets around 10 times as dense as the original corn stover, and with a density that's very similar to that of corn grain. And that allows us then to take those pellets and convey them and ship them and store them in much the same way as we traditionally handle corn grain today.
Now, I really hate to say this, what this looks like to me, this looks like a cross between a high fiber cereal you find at the grocery store and kitty litter.
Absolutely. It does look a lot like the kind of organic breakfast cereal that my wife likes to buy for us at home. It probably tastes about as good as well, to be truthful.
And hopefully better than kitty litter?
Hopefully better than kitty litter.
Why don't you shake it for me a little bit? As opposed to the non-audio rustling of corn stover.
Yes. If we shake corn stover, there's not an awful lot there.
It's like shaking oregano at home over your spaghetti pot.
Very similar, indeed, yes.
At this point, there is now a national competition in which MBI is competing for an award, and this is an area where the public can help out. How does this work?
Yes, MBI and the AFEX 3 technology have been nominated for an award as one of the most transformative technologies of 2014 in a trade journal. It's the Biofuel Digest.
No pun intended.
Absolutely. And the general public can actually vote for this technology by going online and searching for the Biofuels Digest. And there is a nomination page for the AFEX 3 technology. And if you share or you like that page, then that's a vote for our technology.
Jim Nguyen is Director of Bio-Based Technologies De-Risking at MBI on the campus of Michigan State University. Jim, this is a fascinating process. Thank you for explaining it to me, and good luck with this competition.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
So, Kevin, how can people vote for AFEX?
Well, they can go online to biofuelsdigest.com, then just type nominees in the search box. Scroll down to the link that says Transformative Technologies 2014. Click on that and then scroll down to MBI's submission. The deadline is April 18th, and the winner will be announced on the 21st in Washington, D.C.
Okay, current stage Kevin Lavery. Thanks, Kevin.
My pleasure, Mark.
And now, current state contributor Scott Southard offers his take on The Good Luck of Right Now, the latest novel by Matthew Quick, who wrote The Silver Linings Playbook, which was adapted into a film in 2012.
Believing in a destiny can be very addicting. It can add security and maybe even help the world feel like less of a harsh place. But how do you tell the difference between destiny, luck, and just the pure happenstance of living? In Matthew Quick's new novel, The Good Luck of Right Now, he takes on this question through the character of Bartholomew Neal. Bartholomew suffers from a form of mental illness, which may or may not be autism, and is mourning the death of his mother. His mother was his entire life, and with her loss, he finally has to step out into the real world for the first time alone. Bartholomew wants to believe that everything happens for a reason, including the death of his dear mother, and he is always looking for truths to prove that point. The Good Luck of Right Now is an epistolary form, an old tradition in literature that has found success going back to such classics as Pamela, written by Samuel Richardson in 1740. An epistolary novel is one in which the tale is told exclusively through a series of letters. This form of writing can add a very personal element to a narrative, but also a hint of scandal, since we as readers may feel like we're reading something we shouldn't be. While Richardson's Pamela was usually writing to her parents, Matthew Quick has Bartholomew do something a little different and very contemporary. He is writing to Richard Gere. Yes, that Richard Gere. Richard Gere is Bartholomew's imaginary spiritual leader, and he looks to him for direction in all of his choices. Bartholomew breaks down and analyzes Gere's life in his search for answers, from his marriage to Cindy Crawford to his effort to free Tibet. He even has visions of the actor. I can't help but wonder how the real Mr. Gere must feel about this book. The Good Luck of Right Now is filled with imaginative characters like the grieving Bartholomew, from a foul-mouthed man who is mourning the loss of his talking cat to an ex-priest with a massive drinking problem. Each struggling individual Bartholomew meets becomes part of his new extended family and his quest for meaning. There's a lot about The Good Luck of Right Now that I really like. The book feels like a good indie film put to text. I couldn't help but wish, however, that it was a little longer, a little more fleshed out. And there are a few surprises here, leaving you almost wondering how the characters couldn't see some things coming, especially with someone like Bartholomew, who was questioning every decision and every step in his life's journey. The Good Luck of Right Now is not destined to make literary waves like Richardson's Pamela, but chances are you might get a kick out of it, assuming that you're not a certain actor who starred in the movie Chicago. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott's the author of two novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and the Case of the Dangerous Dare. Scott Southard's writing on a variety of topics can be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. The Pure Michigan brand has brought attention to the state's lakes and breweries and museums and other areas. Some are hoping that the Pure Michigan designation may bring the same attention to the state's trail systems. Recently, a five-bill package was introduced to lawmakers that would promote a Pure Michigan trail network. The bill would solidify trail standards and connect trailways with communities. Nancy Krupiars is the executive director of the Michigan Trails and Greenways Alliance, and Nancy's here to tell us more about the Pure Michigan Trails package. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you.
Michigan Trails and Trail Networks have been in the news fairly regularly in recent years. Remind our listeners how extensive the current network of trails is in Michigan.
Well, our organization primarily works with the multi-use trails, which are the abandoned rail trails and connecting multi-use corridors for walking and biking. And we are number one in the country for that, and it's 2,712 miles.
That's the conversion of abandoned railway
yes.
lines
mm-hmm.
into, so that's cross-country skiing, that's hiking, that's
hiking
jogging,
and biking at the very least, and in some cases, equestrian use, ORV,
right.
snowmobile, whatever the community decides will be the use for that trail.
Now, are there new uses for these trails? I mean, when we talk about trails, are we... Obviously, we're talking hiking, biking, skiing. Are there new uses for these trails as well? Or new definitions of trails?
No, it's just that the recently released state trails plan covers all kinds of trails. There are systems for all sorts of trails. We have a snowmobile system, ORV, hiking, winter use, cross-country skiing, mountain biking, and just regular trail biking and walking.
But I understand we may have water trails in
yes,
our future
water
as well.
Trails are an emerging new trail coming on board, and they are working to establish high-quality water trails.
How would those work exactly? How would those be used exactly?
Yeah, those are primarily non-motorized, so they're canoeing and kayaking, and basically what a water trail does is it establishes access points along our rivers and our lakes, and then interpretation, you know, interpretive signage, wayfinding, just maybe even an assistive kayak launch for
okay.
people with disabilities.
So this bill that's currently in the legislature would promote this larger trail network, and part of that promotion includes designating Pure Michigan as part of the idea. You want to attach yourself to that, and includes creation of Pure Michigan Trail Towns.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, Pure Michigan Trails and Pure Michigan Water Trails. What's the payoff of attaching this Pure Michigan designation to this?
Well, Mark, we want to be able to take the best of the best of each type of trail and really develop it and promote it across the nation. We have not had a lot of promotion up to this point, and we want to be able to sort of give the housekeeping seal of approval and get the highest quality trails that represent their type promoted, and there will be a Pure Michigan Trails Fund, and we'll be able to have wayfinding and signage designating these trails. And so we're hoping that this is really going to be sort of a marketing tool, but then also something that the trail entities can aspire to in terms of making their trail live up to the highest quality standards it can.
Okay. What are these trail towns you're proposing?
Well, this is something that has been happening in different states. We've been talking about it for a while now, where communities that have a trail going through their jurisdiction can make the most of their trail being there, whether it's a physical connection to the trail, wayfinding, new services for trail users, incorporating the trail into events, and just things like that where the community is totally aware and working to maximize this asset. And it would require them to form a committee that's sort of a multifaceted committee, kind of like a Main Street approach. And then they would develop an action plan of how they're going to, what they're going to do for the trail to raise it up in their community.
It's a really, there's almost a competitive kind of a vibe
right.
to this whole thing. Has anyone proposed cattle drives through these trail towns?
No.
It kind of conjures up images of the old West, you know, the just that phrase, trail town. So, well, I was curious if anybody had proposed that, an idea whose time has come. Part of this package of bills would also make more information available about the state's trails online. What information is currently available online?
Well, right now it's in a pretty scattered state. We have For instance, the snowmobile trails are often under Michigan Snowmobile Association. We've got a water trail website under Land Information Access Association. We've got our rail trails in our printable trail directory. There are other, you know, it's just sort of haphazard.
It can be systematized, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah. And how will the program be funded?
Well, there is an appropriation this year that we're hoping to get. The governor has proposed $2.5 million for the Showcase Trail. Part of that is for promotion and other sorts of things to really help develop our trail system.
The Showcase Trail?
The governor's trail that we're helping to work on that goes from Belle Isle in Detroit to the border of Michigan and Wisconsin at Ironwood.
And how much of that trail already exists?
Well, it depends because it's hiking and bicycling. And so part of the hiking trail is actually the North Country National Scenic Trail in the Upper Peninsula. And then in the Lower Peninsula, we've got a number of rail trails that already exist that could be used in alignment. And so it may not be the exact same route for hiking and bicycling. It could be sort of a braided effect.
I get it. Sure.
Yeah. So there's, I would say probably about half is on the ground already.
Half is ready to go.
Yeah.
Our guest is Nancy Krupiars, Executive Director of the Michigan Trails and Greenways Alliance, and we're talking about the Pure Michigan Trail Network and plans to establish and strengthen the Pure Michigan Trail Network. Now, you mentioned that Michigan's not the only state developing its trails like this. Did you look at any other states as models here for what we might do?
Well, I know for the trail towns, Kentucky has a state trail towns program.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this one trail that is across many states, the Allegheny Passage. And they have had great success with their trail towns program, and they've been able to measure the economic revenue that's coming in. And it's just such a better welcoming for trail users when they come into a town and they know exactly how to get to town and how to, you know, tap into the services there.
Mm-hmm. Are you a trail user yourself? And if so, how?
Oh,
you
definitely.
A hiker, biker, equestrian, what?
Mostly a bicyclist. We have our annual Michigander. That's a fundraiser for us, but it's a trail ride every year. And it's a week long. And we do have a weekend option, too. And this year we're going up in northwest Michigan, doing Traverse City, Leland, Frankfort, Miesic, Cadillac, Reed City. It's
nice,
a loop.
Nice
yeah.
part of the world.
Yes.
How much do we know about the economic impact of these trails? I mean, apart from just assuming that this will draw visitors to Michigan and stimulate local economies, do we know that this works?
Well, there's been many studies nationwide that have shown there's a number of ways that there is economic impact. For one thing, the property values show about a 10% to 20% increase when they're in proximity to a trail, and we have a lot of studies to back that up.
Okay.
And then recently I was talking to people from the Fred Meyer Heartland Trail, and there's a restaurant bar type of establishment in Riverdale that once the trail went in and was paved all the way to Alma, they experienced a 35% increase.
Wow.
And what they're saying is that all the businesses, well, not all the businesses, but the trail-related businesses are experiencing about 20 to 25% increase.
How interesting. And where does this legislation stand right now?
It passed out of the Senate Committee on Outdoor Recreation and Tourism. And as you know, now the legislature's on break, and so they hope to consider it on the Senate floor when they get back.
Nancy Krupiars is the executive director of the Michigan Trails and Greenways Alliance. Interesting discussion. Interesting the way this is unfolding here in Michigan. Nancy, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good luck. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, a look at the updated Michigan turnaround plan from the organization Business Leaders from Michigan. That and more, including live music. tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Have a great day.